You're listening to There Ought to Be a Law, the Center for Auto Safety podcast with Executive Director Michael Brooks, Chief Engineer Fred Perkins, and hosted by me, Anthony Simino. For over 50 years, the Center for Auto Safety has worked to make cars safer. Hey, listeners.
Good morning. Welcome. If this is going out to the whole wide world, it's kind of awesome.
And the internet, too. It's everywhere. Welcome to the resistance. Now, I'm just kidding. It's another episode of There Ought to Be a Law. We're back. I hope you enjoyed the last two episodes with Phil Copeman. I know I did. He's always a great guest. But now let's start off. One of the questions I've had for the past, I don't know, month is, who's going to lead NHTSA? And NHTSA said, hey, some guy who used to work at Apple is going to lead NHTSA. And you're thinking, wow, Apple, that's really innovative and whatnot. No, they just chose some guy who's a lawyer. We can't find out much about him. We're making the assumption that at Apple he worked on their just no longer viable or in progress auto project, because he seems to be just a lobbyist for the new for car dealers at some point, but now he's the head of NHTSA. So good luck, buddy.
Yeah, it's Jonathan Morrison is the name of the nominee for NHTSA administrator. He was under the first Trump administration. He was brought from, I believe, a pro dealer lobbying, legal and regulatory affairs type background, and served as chief counsel. Overseeing the Trump administration's efforts to deregulate NHTSA, essentially. You know, they did not do many rulemakings at all. I think we've noted before they probably two final rules reached conclusion, and maybe a handful of other proposed rules came out during that time, none of which were highly impactful in regards to safety. Whereas the previous administration, that was not a deregulatory administration, I think they reached close to 30 final rules, maybe more than that. My count's never off, and proposed a number more. So we're assuming that he is coming back in as the head of NHTSA to do much of the same, which is a lot of nothing. As the head of NHTSA, I expect that rulemakings are going to drop significantly. He would be, even as an acting administrator, even if, you know, a lot of wacky nominations have been confirmed so far, this one isn't quite as wacky as some of those. I don't see him having too many difficulties being confirmed in this case. So, you know, we'll continue to monitor that and see how it goes. But ultimately, you know, NHTSA hasn't had an actual confirmed administrator for a few years now, and the one that was in there, Steve Cliff, was only confirmed for 3 months. In the last 8 years, NHTSA's had a confirmed administrator for all of 3 months. And arguably, you don't need a confirmed administrator to get the job done over at NHTSA, or to not get the job done, as the case may be here. So we'll see what happens. We're expecting one of his first actions to be limiting or reducing the role, or just completely getting rid of the standing general order, which is collecting crash data on advanced cruise control vehicles and autonomous vehicles across America. That hasn't happened yet, but it can happen any day now. That's, you know, really, really it. We don't really know what Morrison was doing at Apple for the last few years, but this is essentially a continuation of a very longstanding process of NHTSA where people rotate in and out of industry, which is, you know, a problem for us because there's obviously going to be some conflicts of interest. You know, right now we're worried more about Elon Musk's conflicts of interest having effects over at NHTSA. But, you know, every time an administration comes in or out, there are going to be folks moving into NHTSA from industry, and moving out 4 years to 8 years later when political winds change. And this isn't too much different, although we certainly have never been big fans of that process.
I think you can stop worrying about conflicts of interest with Musk and his musketeers because it's an already established fact. No reason to worry about it anymore.
Yeah, I agree with Fred. Michael, you just got to let it go. It's the new rule at NHTSA and every other agency is whatever Elon wants.
Yeah, you know, I'm having trouble wrapping my head around the fact that, you know, conflict of interest is a very important principle to a lot of lawyers out there. Should be important to, you know, the new acting administrator over at NHTSA, Mr. Morrison, as an attorney. I like having attorneys in charge of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration because in many respects, I think it takes an attorney's approach to really dig in on regulations and the law to get things done. But in this case, it's kind of the opposite. They're digging in on regulations and the law to eliminate safety regulations. And that's a pretty big concern.
Whatever.
I think integrity is so last century. Is it really something we need to think about anymore?
Yeah, everything takes care of itself. Everything drives itself. I don't know what you're complaining about.
I'm just holding out hope that the future might be better.
Oh, it is. It's just not the future you expected.
Yes.
And by better, we mean we'll define that at some future date. Don't mind us as this is going to hurt. Hey, but thinking of things that hurt, our friends at IIHS, they have a new report about an article we're linking to called Supersizing Vehicles Offers Minimal Safety Benefits but Substantial Dangers. Quoting from the article, for vehicles that weigh less than the fleet average, the risk that occupants will be killed in a crash decreases substantially for every 500 pounds of additional weight. But those benefits top out quickly. For vehicles that weigh more than the fleet average, there's hardly any decrease in risk for occupants associated with additional poundage. By poundage, I assume they mean the weight of the vehicle as soon as you're going to get pounded with it. But my question is for Fred. I don't think I fully understand this. For vehicles that weigh less than the fleet average, I get that. The risk that occupants will be killed in a crash decreases substantially for every 500 pounds of additional weight. So if the cars get heavier, I'm safer? Or they get what?
Did you take physics in high school?
Yes. Force equals mass times acceleration.
Well, one of the early problems they put to you in physics is what happens when something heavy crashes into something light. And basically, the heavy thing continues and the light thing bounces off. You can do this yourself at home by throwing a tennis ball against the floor. The floor doesn't move a hell of a lot. The tennis ball does. Okay. So that's basically the recoil effect is what we're talking about. As the weight of a light object approaches the weight of a heavy object, then the recoil tends to be less. So there are fewer acceleration forces on the smaller object as it gets heavier and reaches an equilibrium with the heavier object. If the two objects are equally heavy and they're coming together at the same speed, then they're going to meet in the middle and neither one's going to rebound. They'll just crash together. So that's exactly what's happening here. With a lighter car, it bounces back. You get a lot of acceleration, very damaging to the people inside the car. With a heavier car, if it's equal, it doesn't bounce back as much, so the acceleration is less. The problem is that as both vehicles get heavier, the actual amount of energy in the collision increases, right? So if you smash two really heavy objects together, the result's not pretty. I mean, think of one boulder dropping onto another boulder, right? They both break up. It's very dramatic. But if you drop a pebble onto a boulder, the boulder doesn't move. The pebble bounces off, right? So okay. That's basically what's happening here.
So if I have a Hummer EV that's pushing close to 10,000 pounds, and you have a Hummer EV, if I load up my Hummer EV with a bunch of lead and I add 2,000 pounds of weight to it, I'm going to win in our crash?
You're going to...
I think
actually,
win is a
you're
bad,
going to
bad
assure that
to
you both that. Lose. That's what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And you're just increasing the depth of the hole that you're going to find after the accident.
Wait, so bigger is not always better?
Bigger is not always better, though. And, you know, I'm taller, so maybe there is something to that. But
No. I think that qualifies it right there, because you're tall and I am an average sized man in the Roman army.
It's important here to look at, you know, the 4,000 pound number in this study. That's basically the average weight of vehicles on the road. And what they were looking at, you know, if you add 500 pounds to a car, an SUV, or a pickup that's already under 4,000 pounds, you're looking at saving lives. I mean, you're going to have 17 fewer deaths in cars per million registered vehicle years is how they worked the data out. 13 fewer deaths in SUVs. And in the pickup, it's still a little shaky. You're not going to get a whole lot of benefit there. But when you add 500 pounds to cars, SUVs, or pickups that are over 4,000 pounds, you're going to see two more deaths per those million registered vehicle years in the car and in the SUV. Car-to-car collisions, you're going to see two more deaths in the vehicle and SUV collision, but you're going to see seven more deaths in the vehicle that's being hit by a pickup. So the pickups are really concerning in this study, you know, and we've talked about them a lot, and the battery weight that's being added into electric pickups and how that's impacting crashes. I mean, essentially what this study is showing is that for every pound you go higher than 4,000, you're somewhat increasing the risk to drivers and other vehicles. You're not necessarily increasing the risk to yourself as the driver of one of these heavy trucks, but you're contributing to a huge problem on our roads. And, you know, the odds of you killing someone in a crash are going up significantly. You know, they mentioned in the article that it's probably, you know, it probably makes sense to transition to lighter pickups for people who aren't carrying heavy payloads. You know, I've talked before about the guys who are in a suit and tie and drive their, you know, 6,000 pound pickup into their office. It doesn't make sense. And it doesn't make sense to the Insurance Institute either. It's something that I think we really need to get a hold of in America, although I'm not sure if the current government has the stomach to regulate in this area.
All right. Well, there's another factor here, actually, which is that every car has got energy absorbing mechanisms in the front so that when you crash into something, it'll protect the occupants, right? That's what a lot of the crash standards are all about. The problem is if you have two vehicles that are very heavy, you saturate the energy absorbing mechanism if they're aligned. And so, you know, once you've saturated the energy absorbing mechanism, it can't absorb anymore. Another problem that they noted in the article is that the design of the pickup trucks in particular were not aligned vertically with the energy absorbing mechanisms of the smaller vehicles. So the pickups in a head-to-head crash would tend to override the smaller vehicle and just ride up over the hood. And in that case, the energy absorbing mechanism is voided because it's, you know, riding up over on top of the mechanism. This is a technique that the Russians used against the German tanks in the Battle of Kursk. But again, I digress.
So what you're suggesting for me and my Toyota Corolla is I jack up the height of it so I can be taller than a Dodge Durango, and I cover the front of it with one of those cattle catcher things.
I'm not actually suggesting that, but
That's what it sounds like.
Have fun with that.
I think this is a great idea. Okay. Listeners, tell us what dumb ideas you have for adding weight to your vehicles and becoming a death trap on the road. But while you're doing that, go to autosafety.org and click on donate. And the more you donate, the more we'll listen to your insane ideas. Mainly, it's just my ideas. Your ideas are much better than mine. Continuing with the Insurance Institute for Auto Highway Safety. Wow, it's been a while, folks. Okay.
Welcome back, Anthony.
Thanks. Another good article from them is automakers make big strides in front crash prevention. Now, we've talked about this a lot. And back in April last year, the IIHS tested a bunch of small SUVs to see how well they do this with improvements to automatic emergency braking. And we've talked about this, and only three of the small 10 SUVs performed well enough. And now, I mean, less than a year later, 22 of the latest 30 vehicles evaluated earned good or acceptable rating. This is great. Automatic emergency braking works no matter what their lobbyist groups tell you. It's impossible. It's too hard. We can't do this. But less than a year later, they're like, hey, we're kicking ass doing this. I mean, the cognitive dissonance at their lobbyists must be mind-blowing. Or they just don't care. They don't care. Right?
Well, but did you ever hear the expression, it's difficult for people to understand something when their paycheck depends on their not understanding it?
How do I get one of those paychecks?
What? Say that again.
Okay. Michael. AEB works, right?
AEB definitely works. I mean, IHS, I believe this is the first, this is one of the first times that IHS has run them through its new AEB test. You know, their original one, which was the one that essentially the industry voluntary agreement that was in place since 2016, 2017, that was fulfilled in 2023, tested to 12 and 25 miles per hour, which, as we've noted, is, you know, kindergarten level speeds. You don't see a lot of crashes, deaths, injuries at those speeds. That's something that the new automatic emergency braking rule that NHTSA came out with was meant to fix, make manufacturers protect occupants at higher speeds using automatic emergency braking. IHS updated their tests to a 31 mile per hour, 37 mile per hour, and a 43 mile per hour test, which all are still somewhat lower than the top speeds of NHTSA's proposed rule. And you know, they tested another run of vehicles, and these vehicles all, you know, 22 of them earned a good or acceptable rating, which is certainly looks like an improvement within 1 year, which suggests that the manufacturers shouldn't have a extremely difficult, at least not as difficult as they're contending that it is, a difficult road to better automatic emergency braking that meets the new NHTSA standard. They're currently challenging it in court, and the rule is probably being looked at by the Trump administration for any weakness they can use to try to get it off the books. But I don't think that is going to be able to happen in the short term. So, you know, it's another thing that's interesting about these tests. If you look at the vehicles that did well, you will see, you know, the Toyotas. Then Toyota is the Toyota Corolla Hybrid, I believe, is the one vehicle that passed NHTSA's new test up to 50 miles per hour and did well in the pedestrian detection as well. You'll see the Toyotas and Lexuses are doing very well in automatic emergency braking, as well as Mercedes and BMW. Hyundai seems to be doing pretty good. They're mostly good rated. They're kind of acceptable in a couple spots. American manufacturers are mixed. You know, there's Ford's marginal. So Chevy's get poor ratings. Nissan gets poor ratings. So as you can see from this story, and I would recommend that everybody take a look at this, because it's a good way to look at what kind of technology is going into the next car you buy. If you want good automatic emergency braking, there are certain manufacturers that are currently doing it better than other and making better equipment standard on vehicles than others. And it also kind of gives you an inside view as to why we're seeing the Alliance for Automotive Innovation, which is strongly backed by the American manufacturers, General Motors and Ford, who have fairly low performing or poor performing vehicles in this test, why they appear to be opposed to the new automatic emergency braking rule. So it's something that we hope is only going to get better, but a lot of that is going to depend on the industry playing ball and putting safety above profits.
Hey, Anthony, if our attentive listeners want to find this reference and go to that article themselves, where would they find that link?
It's in the description for this podcast, using whatever podcast service you have. There'll be descriptions and links to everything. Or you can go to autosafety.org/podcast and you can see all of our previous podcast episodes. And there's links and descriptions all there too.
Oh, thank
One
you.
thing also that's worth noting on this, the vehicles seem to do really badly in detecting and responding to motorcycle targets, which suggests they might also be have problems detecting and responding to cyclists. IHS only tests motorcycles, not cyclists, I believe. So it's something to note that, you know, the vehicles are detecting other vehicles, cars in front of them, and most of them are doing a moderate to good job of or acceptable to good job of stopping, but motorcyclists are still at high risk here.
So Michael, the question I have for you is, so the auto industry lobbying group is saying, hey, AB is impossible, we can't do it. The auto manufacturers are like, hey, we keep doing this really well, we keep getting better, as we've just seen with this IHS report. And so if the current administration or any future administration says, hey, AB's bullshit, we don't need this, let's get rid of it, it's woke transgender ideology, is there any situation in the past where auto manufacturers are like, well, let's remove this stuff we've just invested, you know, millions and millions of dollars and put into our cars and put a part of marketing campaigns and things like that?
Well, you know, I question how much they actually have invested in the technology. I mean, I noted in one of their press releases, they said they'd invested $1 billion in AEB, which sounds like a lot until you know that AEB has been developed for 20 years across, you know, 20 different manufacturers, which means they're investing a grand total of what, $2.5 million per year, which then doesn't sound like a whole lot when you consider what the industry is burned on autonomous vehicles, which is in the tens of billions, if not hundreds of billions of dollars.
I'm talking about responsible auto manufacturers like Toyota, like the Japanese manufacturers, like Mercedes, the Germans, not the U.S. burning billions on GM.
Well, if they want to, you know, ultimately, I think that if automatic emergency braking is succeeding at higher speeds and you're the manufacturer that has automatic emergency braking that's protecting pedestrians and motorcyclists and stopping your vehicle reliably at high speeds, people are going to gravitate towards that, and you're going to win out in the sales side, which is ultimately what's going to matter here. What I really am fearful of is that the lawsuit by the Alliance would succeed and the AEB rule could be thrown out, or the Trump administration finds some way to weaken the rule, and manufacturers are then going to continue this incredibly slow rollout of automatic emergency braking that, you know, if we could get good technology into the vehicles now, we're going to save hundreds or thousands of lives over the next few years before all vehicles have really good automatic emergency braking, which is ultimately the goal. It's really a matter of how many people and how many lives can we save and injuries can we prevent by getting this stuff into cars at a reasonable pace versus delaying it and allowing it to be sold as optional equipment for another 20 years.
So I suggest, as a consumer, next time you have to go buy a car, when you go into the dealership, say, hey, does this vehicle have automatic emergency braking? Does it work at high speeds?
Yeah, they're all going to have automatic emergency braking at this point. You need to determine as a consumer whether it's the kind that works at 25 miles per hour and offers some protection, but very small amounts. Or is it going to be the type that detects pedestrians, detects motorcyclists, and detects other vehicles all at high speeds and actually really prevents some of the major tragedies we see on our roads?
So the rationale for the regulation in part is to make sure that every manufacturer who says they have AEB has some minimum level of capacity associated with the AEB. Right now, any manufacturer can say they've got AEB and they don't have to say it's bad, it doesn't work, right? There's no standard against which people are comparing the AEB. So that's a very important part of the rule, not just to say what the maximum capabilities are, but also to make sure that the minimum capabilities are in fact embraced by every manufacturer.
All right, I'm going to jump to what I want to call gaslighting. Is an article from the Washington Post titled, I pitted hands-free driving tech against I-95 speeding drivers. where there's a reporter for the Washington Post gets a car that has GM Super Cruise system. They're some version of ADAS where you can be hands-free on pre-mapped highways, and goes for it. And so according from the article, the car's computer brain decided whether to make way for the onrushing cars from other reason to shift into the right lane. He's talking about he's driving in the left lane and some jackass is behind him. And as happens a lot, they try to say, hey, let's see if I can get into your trunk. And so again, the car's computer brain decided whether to make way for the onrushing car for some other reason to shift into the right lane. In the same moment, the speeder swerved towards the same space to pass on the right. Like, this happens constantly. Like, you're in the fast lane, some fool's trying to get in your trunk, and you're like, hey, I'll move out of your way. And they're like, I'm moving out of my way, and do this. And so, of course, his car freaks out. He has to immediately take control and avoid this crash. Further from the article, it was a startling reminder that this technology required me to exercise a high degree of vigilance even while riding along in a mode that functions like autopilot. This is a perfect example, folks, of your car is not driving yourself, no matter what they say. So the gaslighting is to the entire automotive industry that claims they have some autopilot-like function. Mic drop.
Yeah, I mean, this was a pretty good article. I mean, somewhat impartial. I mean, the guy said that, you know, his last line in the article is, my experience using Super Cruise suggests even a brief lapse by computer or driver could have serious consequences, which it's a huge concern that you know, that's even a statement about a system that is pretty clearly not a safety system. I mean, the article notes that GM is very carefully trying to advertise this system without promoting it as a safety system. It is purely a convenience system. And that's something I think all of our listeners need to understand. All of your adaptive cruise control systems are not there to keep you safe. They are feature of the vehicle that is for convenience. It's so that you can do whatever you have to do, whatever you seem to you think you need to do while your vehicle is moving down the road at speed, and think you can get away with it without paying full attention to the driving task. I personally just don't have a use for these systems at the moment because I'm too scared. Maybe I'm a weenie. Whatever it is, I feel like I will get distracted. I'm fairly distractible at the base level, and you know, in a vehicle where my car is changing lanes and keeping distance from other cars and essentially, you know, performing a lot of the tasks that I need to on the interstate for me, I have no doubt that my mind is going to drift, and that when that moment comes that I need to take over, I'm not going to be there mentally and available to take over. And so there's a trade-off here, and I don't think the trade-off is good. You're trading convenience for an increased risk of a crash. And I think that's just, it's not where we need to be headed as a country, even though it looks like that's where we're going, as we see so many manufacturers advertising all of these convenience features and even starting to say, hey, you can check your email and do all these other things while you're supposed to be maintaining supervision over the vehicle. It doesn't make sense to me. There's a logical incongruence there that just, it doesn't work in the end. And I think ultimately we're going to see people who are seeking convenience or leisure time in their car being killed like they are right now in Teslas with autopilot or full self-drive. It's only a matter of time. You know, we've seen incidents with Blue Cruise not detecting stationary vehicles. All these systems are being built in different ways, and all of them have their own little particular features that are all directed at driver convenience, but don't do a whole lot for the safety side. So I'd have to say at this point, based on everything we've seen about advanced driver assistance systems, we're not big fans.
There's another factor related to that, Michael, I think, which is that these capabilities are being advertised as convenience features. In fact, they're not, because they're actually adding to the workload of the driver, because not only do you have to be attentive to everything that's happening around you, but you also have to monitor the performance of this automated system that's supposed to be taking care of these issues around you. So you not only have to do everything that you need to do when you're driving, but you also have to become a computer mechanic and make sure that everything that's supposed to be happening with the computer driving your car is in fact happening. So I think that the argument that it in fact reduces your workload is very, very weak. I think in reality, it increases your workload, increases the hazard associated with driving, and really makes you less likely to reach your destination safely.
All right, I will tie this example to my favorite thing to do now, which is sailing. And so I was just taking the sailing course, and we have to change who's on the helm, who's driving the boat every few hours, because your attention's going to wane. And we don't have onrushing traffic at us. There's no imminent danger, really, when you're out of port, you're out there. But your attention's going to wane, and you can see that whoever's driving the boats, they start to fall off their attention. We had an issue where we had maybe 10 minutes warning before we can see a cruise ship coming towards us, and we didn't know what they're going to do. So you'd get on the radio and be like, hey, what's your intention? They told us, oh, great, we'll do this, you do that. There's no way to do that in an automobile. There's no way to be asking the guy behind you, what's your intention? I know what his intention is. His intention is trying to run me over. So to have some sort of automated way to do this, I think, is naive. I just want to talk about sailing. That's it. Sorry.
Well, basically, you had full self-sailing with human supervision. So you're doing the same thing that Waymo's doing.
Right, but with much less danger involved, one would hope.
Well, pending rocks, yeah.
Yes, so that's my gaslight. I painted the entire ADAS industry. Fred, you got a gaslight?
Oh, I do. This is actually a good one, I think.
Well, depending because on who's listening.
Because it's multidimensional.
Oh, shit.
Let me see. I know your brother wants them really quick. What the hell do we do with that?
I mean, this is a time test, Fred. Come on, you can't even. Come on, let's go.
I got a. How's that working?
Hey, Michael,
for
you
Kyle,
got one?
Though.
Wait.
Mine is going directly to just this insanity that of an article Anthony sent out last. I don't know if you were on a boat or not when you sent that to me.
It
goes to the parents in San Francisco who are sticking their children into robo-taxis alone. And, you know, I believe against the terms of service that Waymo requires them to agree with. I don't think Waymo wants this happening either. But it's these people who are just giving these glowing reviews of Waymo taking their daughter or their son to school or to other places when the parents don't have time to do that themselves or don't want to do it themselves.
Yep.
And, you know, they're saying things like, oh, well, they wouldn't feel comfortable in an Uber or Lyft. You know, I can see that argument. You know, if you have a minor child, sticking them into a car with a stranger can feel risky. That's perfectly understandable. But then sticking them into an autonomous vehicle where that child, you know, depending on their age, is going to have to communicate with you know, if something happens during the drive, if they need to stop the car or have to communicate with the vehicle, are they going to be capable of doing that? Are they old enough and mature enough to even be able to handle that type of responsibility? Maybe some kids are, maybe some kids aren't. But ultimately, you know, if Waymo has an operating design domain for safety, right, which we know they do, right now, that operating design domain does not include transporting children who are unsupervised in the vehicles because it's against their terms of service. They're not even anticipating this. Maybe they should now that this article's come out. But this is a problem. It's something, you know, I think there was a gray area there with Uber as well and Lyft, you know. And it's probably a gray area that should be resolved before we start throwing, toddlers into autonomous vehicles to send them to daycare. There need to be some rules, if not, state laws around this kind of issue, because this is exactly the type of area where a state would traditionally regulate. And if it's something that needs to be resolved before autonomous vehicles start creeping onto the roads in many more cities across America.
Yeah, we're linking to this article. It's in the SF Standard, and I'm going to quote from it. "It was instantly awesome," said the San Francisco resident Chris, who chose to only use his first name because he didn't want to have his Waymo account banned and for Child Protective Services to take his kids away. "We don't have to worry about her getting home ever." Oh, God, you should. man, that's just bad.
Except for that time where she was circling a parking lot for 2 hours, right?
Yeah, and this is the thing that blows me away. Like, this is not needed at all, because he says his daughter typically takes the bus to school and either Chris or his wife take her home. Why doesn't the bus take her home, too? Like, if it takes her to school, it's just like, bah, it's insane. Later in the article, he says he doesn't regret using Waymo extra legally. Basically, what you're just talking about, Michael, where it's like, hey, these are the terms of service. And he's like, yeah, whatever. I'll put a 9-year-old girl in the car. I am willing to skirt the rules because I love it so much. Yeah. people are nuts. This is what it comes down to. People are dumb. Just dumb. That's a good gaslight. Fred, I mean, I don't think you have a chance of beating this one, especially you say it's multidimensional.
It is, and somehow I pushed the wrong button and I destroyed it. So,
bummer.
So I'll try to do it from memory. So forgive me if I miss a couple of details. But it's the the Automated Vehicle Industry Association put out a press release saying that they had seen a report from the Chamber of Progress that said that the AVs are really a good thing and they reduce safety and all that. So my question to you, Anthony, is why does the chamber even work on something like this?
What is the Chamber of Progress?
Oh, you didn't fall for it.
Are you talking about the Chamber of Commerce? Yeah.
Yeah, well, that was the first dimension of this gaslight is that, what the hell is the Chamber of Progress? And I immediately went to the Chamber of Commerce website to try to verify this. And of course, there's nothing there. So I backed into looking at the Chamber of Progress. And it turns out that the Chamber of Progress is essentially
a lost Harry Potter novel.
There's an advocacy group with all the same members as the Automated Vehicle Industry Association. So really, this whole report is self-referential. But if you go to the chamberofprogress.org website, it turns out that they've appropriated all of the symbols and the memes associated with progressive politics and put it into a package that advocates for self-driving vehicles. So it was, it's a wonderful gaslight because, number one, it's not accurate. Number two, it's self-referential. And number three, it's very confusing because it really refers to the Chamber of Progress, which doesn't actually exist, and confuses people about the origin of this. Because, I'm very sophisticated, and I went to the Chamber of Commerce website to try to verify this as well. So anyway, my congratulations to AVIA for outstanding work on a gaslight for this week.
That is an excellent one. I love the Chamber of Progress. That little wizard kid, he's going to get out of it one day. But Michael wins this week's gaslight. I'm saying it. He won. That was really good. Chamber of Progress. Ridiculous. Hey, Fred, are you ready to continue with your dulcet tones and give us the Tao?
You've now entered the Tao. I can do that.
Yes, sir.
All right. This week,
I haven't even destroyed this document, so I'm making progress too. So, Anthony, have you ever thought about purchasing an equity new issue or read a prospectus?
Wait, I've read a prospectus. I don't know what an equity new issue is. Wait, equity?
Well, whenever an equity has a new issue, they send out a prospectus.
Yes,
which
I've read
people
a prospectus.
Are supposed to read and be careful. And it's interesting that if you read the prospectus, it's full of warnings. It's every one of them says past performance is no guarantee of future results. And then they have a whole long list of risk factors for investors to make sure that you understand the risks before you put your money into it. And I thought, as I thought about this, it's interesting that people in America, the legal system has much more regard for capital than they do for human lives. Because if you are investing money in a trip in a Waymo, nobody says to you, past performance is no guarantee of future results. And here are the risk factors associated with using Waymo. So I've thought about why is it that capital, dollars, is so much more important than human life in America? And this really goes back to a fundamental property or fundamental part of history, which is the primacy of capital over human lives derives from something called war capitalism versus industrial capitalism.
Have you been reading Karl Marx again?
No, actually, I've been reading Empire of Cotton by Sven Becker, who looked at the progress of cotton manufacturing, and all of the military activities and slavery and subjugation that was required to preserve the capital invested in cotton and cotton production. And actually, a necessary part of this whole capital structure was the proliferation of slavery, primarily in the American South, to preserve and defend the capital, the dollars that were being invested by both the North and the South in the production of cotton. So this actually, it seems to me, the fact that people are fed bullshit by the AV manufacturers and have their lives put at risk without any warning actually harkens back to the same kind of litigation that was required to promote slavery in the American South. This pervades all the labor practices in America. But anyway, that's not exactly on point, I don't think. But, you know, if we go back to our friends at Cruise, right? Kyle was very fond of saying they never drive distracted, drowsy, or drunk. But he never talked about past performance is no guarantee of future results. Never talked about the risk factors associated with the AAVs. So I wonder how that's working out for Kyle these days.
Well, I mean, his company doesn't exist anymore, and they got rid of him.
Ah, I see. So you think maybe integrity in development of AAVs would be a better idea in the long run than feeding people bullshit about the safety of the vehicles? Maybe.
Well, I mean, how's your retirement portfolio doing?
That's another one. Anyway, that's the Tao of this week, the relationship between war capitalism, industrial capitalism, slave laws in the United States, and the fact that getting into an AV is full of undocumented risk that you might want to think about.
I like that one. I like the past performance is no guarantee of future results, especially with the AV industry, because who knows what version software you're running. I mean, there's no past performance if they've just upgraded everything.
Why is it before you put a dollar into a stock purchase, you get this warning, but when you put your life at risk getting into an AV, you don't get any similar warning. So that's odd.
That's why I put all my money into meme coins. That's right. If you have a bunch of cryptocurrency nonsense and you're like, I got to get rid of this money, go to autosafety.org and click on donate. No, we do not accept cryptocurrency. But you can convert cryptocurrency into real currency. Yeah, that fiat currency, not fiat the cars, fiat currency, and we'll gladly take that. Why don't we say take cryptocurrency? I don't know. It sounds annoying.
Because cryptocurrency is basically just a momentarily legal form of Ponzi schemes. It's not real money, but
if you have a lot of cryptocurrency, ignore what Fred's saying. We love it. Sell now
and support us.
Anyway, hey, let's talk about. You guys ever hear of the Ford Pinto?
had one.
You had one?
Yeah.
Why? Did you lose a bet?
Why? Well, because I didn't have any money and the woman I married had one. So there you go.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Michael, you've heard of it, right?
I rode in one often as a child. We had a green wagon with wood panel, fake wood panel on the side. It was an excellent little car. But it was not one of the ones that was exploding. I think it came after that era.
After they moved the gas tank? Well, mm-hmm. Mother Jones has an article where they're saying the Cybertrucks are deadlier than the Ford Pinto. An analysis published Thursday by the auto news website Fuel Arc, which I've never heard of, found that in their 1 year of existence, the approximately 34,000 Cybertrucks on the roads had five fire fatalities, giving them a fatality rate of 14.5 per 100,000 units. That's 17 times the fatality rate of the Ford Pintos. But okay, so I've got a couple of questions on this, Michael, because you made that sound, which means I don't think so.
I really appreciated Mother Jones' coverage on the original Ford Pinto issue, which I think took place maybe before I was born, early 70s.
It was 72.
In this case, they're quoting a study from a website called Fuel Arc that gives all these numbers that I'm not even going to repeat about a fatality rate that's higher than the Ford Pintos. But they're, you know, this website that did this fatality rate, I put that in quotes, analysis, counted the fatality of the guy who shot himself in the head and packed the vehicle with fireworks and lit it on fire outside of the Trump International Hotel in Vegas. That is not good crash data, right? That is a really, really bad approach to crash data. There wasn't a crash. The Cybertruck had literally nothing to do with the death that happened there or the fire. Instantly, I think we need to dismiss that study. And that is the basis of this article, which I'm just going to have to, that could have been my gaslight of the week, but I didn't want to throw them under the bus, but now I'm doing it.
There you go.
That's just terrible crash data. And I also don't see how, you know, they've had five fire fatalities in a year, but they're doing a fatality rate by units sold. And, you know, it's just an odd comparison. I don't think that fatality rate study is going to hold up under any scrutiny, even mine.
Wow. I mean, but we know the Cybertruck has been pretty much a crappy vehicle. It's hasn't been out that long. It's already had seven recalls, the most recent being December 17th. And that's probably their last recall ever, because that was under a different administration. And this new administration, there'll never be a recall against the Cybertruck. They'll be the opposite. They'll be this is a feature.
We'll see. I mean, the Cybertruck has its own little life online, right? I mean, I think you may have noticed a week or two ago where there was supposedly the State Department was going to spend $400 million on a contract for Cybertrucks. That was the reference to Cybertrucks was removed pretty quickly from that bid. And it doesn't look like that's happening, although I would, you know, I don't know why any government agency that wants to get from point A to point B safely would be investing in Cybertrucks. That didn't make a whole lot of sense to me. But, you know, who knows? It could still happen. They're just trying to hide it. We never know these days. But, you know, and I'll add, the Cybertruck actually was tested by NCAP recently, and it just came out, and they got, you know, 5 stars in the frontal crash ratings, 5 stars in the side crash ratings, 4 stars in rollover ratings. So it's not perfect. But what NCAP doesn't take into account are things like this, right? The fuel integrity of the vehicle, which, you know, the Cybertrucks do seem to be catching on fire at a higher rate than your average vehicle. They also are incredibly heavy and made out of materials that are somewhat unusual for the industry. And we think they're going to have negative impacts on anyone who comes into contact with them in a collision, based on the weight and the cold rolled stainless steel and all the armor and all the junk that's been going into these cars. So, you know, Cybertrucks are definitely way down on our list of favorite vehicle, and probably one of the most, besides being the ugliest vehicle on the road, and besides, you know, if you drive one, I've said it before, you just look like a dick. besides all of that, you know, they do have a concerning record in fire fatalities, which this article is attempting to point out, unfortunately, using a study that is fundamentally flawed itself.
So you heard it here first, folks. The man who said, "I might be a weenie," says if you drive a Cybertruck, you look like a dick. I think that sums it up perfectly. Hey, Fred, I got a question for you. Let's pretend you run a U.S. auto manufacturer. Do you have active hostility towards the people who bought your cars, or do you think that they're good people?
I don't care as long as they pay.
Ah, well,
why would I have an opinion?
That's very different than what Jeep's doing, because Jeep's saying, hey, customers, we think you suck. Jeep is putting pop-up ads in their infotainment systems. That's right. You're driving along using your infotainment system because you've got a map on it. You don't know where you're going. And then you pull up to a stop sign or a stoplight and you stop the vehicle. And now it's boom, buy a hot dog. Boom, here's a way to regrow your hair. Boom, here's some other ridiculous ad. Your map's gone. You're confused because Jeep's saying, hey, here's an ad that's important for you. And now as the driver, you're panicked. You're going, why did I buy a Jeep? And how do I close this ad? And so then you got to click this closed and go back to your ad. And you're like, go back to your map. And then you're going down. And then, oh, another stop sign, stoplight, another ad. So I think if you own a Jeep, you're never going to see anybody stop the car ever again because it just makes the car more dangerous. I don't understand
why AI is so great, because it allows those ads to be carefully targeted to you.
Well,
yeah, this is a mess. I mean, it's if this is happening while the vehicle is in operation, this kind of thing should be banned. First of all, you're requiring someone driving a car to look over to their touchscreen, read the message, and X out of it while they're driving the car. That's a terrible idea. Stellantis Jeep is claiming it was a temporary software glitch. I think that's, you know, a lot of cover in their ass there. It sounds like something that was just a really bad idea, but a way to, you know, help them make some more profits as their share of the market is dipping. Yeah, but, you know, it's a terrible idea. There should not be ads. I mean, if an ad pops up when you park your car in the driveway, or maybe even right when you start the car in your driveway, it's one thing. But the second that vehicle transmission goes into gear, those ads should be automatically removed from any touchscreen that has maps or, you know, any type of safety related function in the vehicle.
There should never be any advertising inside my vehicle at all, Michael. Nope. I don't care if I'm parked, I'm in a garage, anything. If I've paid good money for this vehicle, why am I seeing an ad for, you know, watermelon spritzers? Sure, I love a watermelon spritzer just as the next person, but I don't need to have an ad for it. I thought Jeep actually claimed that this was part of their deal with Sirius XM. That we have to do this.
They claim that as well. The ad that I saw that was popping up in the vehicles and when it was first reported was an ad for some type of Stellantis extended warranty. So this was something that was popping up, you know, on vehicles that were, you know, a year old too. So, right, they're not even in the position to be even thinking about an extended warranty at that point, which makes it double stupid.
Well, I think it'd be a great place for other manufacturers to buy ad space. Hate this pop-up ad? Go buy a Honda. Anyway, let's jump into recalls.
I think it's a great idea because, you know, think if you had teenage children, they're borrowing your car, they're, you know, getting on a secluded lover's lane somewhere and climbing into the back seat. It would be really great if the cameras, you know, look at them and a message comes over from you saying, get back in the front seat and don't do that. You know, I think it's, you know, the real issue here is who owns that space? Who owns that visual image that's appearing on your screen? Is it you, the owner of the car, or is it somebody else? And I think the companies are pushing very hard to say, no, we own the screen. You're just borrowing it for some driving purposes, but we really own it and we can do with it whatever we want. The same way that they want to lease you the seat warmer and other capabilities that you thought you were buying in the car. They're really creeping towards getting you to finance a vehicle that allows them to do value-added programming after the fact that it addresses their captive audience, you in the car.
All right, you've got my vote. No more cars, people. Let's get rid of them. Hey, if we get rid of cars, we've solved all the auto safety issues. Boom! Winning. I don't know. Can't believe you guys haven't figured this out over the last 50 years. All right, let's go to recalls. Let's start up with General Motors. 70,768 vehicles. The 2022 GMC Sierra 1500. Oh, thank God. I was afraid it was going to be a whole bunch of different ones. But this is their hood molding. The front grille deflector detaches unexpectedly while driving. That's not good. Deflectors flying off the car?
Yeah, basically there's a chrome grille deflector. It's only the chrome one. So if you don't have a chrome one on your 2022 Sierra 1500, then you don't have to worry. But there were actually, GM said they got 1,200 plus field complaints related to this problem. So there were a lot of chrome deflectors flying off of GMC Sierras in the past couple of years, and including four allegations of an accident that occurred due to this problem. So there's your safety issue. Essentially, they did a mid-cycle enhancement is what it was called, but it looks like that mid-cycle enhancement for those Sierras actually was a mid-cycle degrading of their vehicles, because this chrome deflector problem started right after that. And essentially the attachment points for these, I guess it's like an emblem or something that's on the front grille of the vehicle. The attachment points didn't adequately withstand expected loads is how they phrase it in their technical jargon. But that one looks like it's going to be a couple of months. Looks like they're kind of taking their time getting the notifications out to owners, which suggests they don't have a remedy yet. And so owners may be waiting even further past March for a fix for this.
Next up, Toyota. 40,922 vehicles. The 2025 Toyota Camry Hybrid, the Lexus NX250, the NX350, pages and pages and pages. They have non-compliance, huh? The second row center seatbelt. Incorrect tooling during a hot knife cutting process. Oh, I love a hot knife cutting process. The seatbelt webbing may have been damaged. That's not good. And it violates which federal motor vehicle safety standard, Michael? Come on.
That one's 209 in this one.
I was looking for 209 paragraph S4.2B. But
yeah, we're not getting that granular. This one is interesting. I mean, they've discovered through their research that less than 0.1% of all of the seatbelt webbing in these vehicles is actually damaged, but they're going to require everyone who owns one of these 40,000 or so vehicles to bring their vehicles in, because they don't know which vehicles have this problem. So when you get a notice for this recall, definitely take your vehicle in. As we talk about a lot, seatbelts are they're number one in safety by far, over airbags, over any type of technology that's come out in the last 20 years. And if your seatbelt webbing is damaged, you may have some serious issues in a crash. So anyone who owns a 24 to 25 Toyota or Lexus, looks like you're going to be finding out about this in late March, early April. Be sure to go to your dealer and have your vehicle inspected to make sure you're not one of those 0.1% of the folks affected.
Excellent. Last up, another surprise, Toyota. 106,061 vehicles, the 2024 to 2025 Toyota Tacoma. And it is just that. This is a flexible hose rear brake hose issue. The four-wheel drive vehicles are equipped with a 16-inch brake systems where the brake hoses attached to a rear brake calipers transfer brake fluid under hydraulic pressure. And the leaking, there's mud buildup, and the mud and dirt can contact the brake hoses, and that may damage and wear through the brake hoses, causing a brake fluid leak. So if you're using this truck as a truck person would, and you're going off road, and you're like, hey, let's drive through the mud and go rum 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 rah, all that mud and that dirt can get up there and degrade these brake hoses. And but if you're just a guy wearing a suit and a cowboy hat just driving from office park to office park, don't worry about it.
Yeah, I would say worry about it anyway. Who knows what's going to happen with road debris getting up in there. And essentially, it looks like they've got a fix ready for this. They're going to replace the rear brake hoses with improved models. So both of your rear brake hoses are going to be replaced. So go in and get your brand new brake hoses, and you can expect to hear about that from Toyota. And hopefully a repair will be available by early April.
All right. And with that, that is another episode of the show. Everyone happy? Excited?
I'm happy. Glad to be back.
All right. Great. Till next week, folks, please like, subscribe, give 5 stars, rate us 2 thumbs up, 3 thumbs up. You know, I don't know what your anatomy's like. I don't know how many thumbs you got.
Polydactyls everywhere.
Polydactyls everywhere. Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
For more information, visit www.autosafety.org.